It had been like a horrific cross between cancer and civil war. The entire ecosystem that was the dirigible behemoth or Sansamin was tearing itself apart. Now others were joining in. They had discovered its name through description. 974 Praff had flown round it, recording any distinguishing marks not altered or obliterated by the destruction taking place, then landed on the little hummock of naked envelope skin, high on its back, where the Raptor scout troop had established its primary base. The interpreter had communicated its findings via the giant seed-shaped signaling pod in the center of the hastily established compound. The pod's infrared light had found Iolaus, tens of kilometers above, and then received the reply a little later. According to the library memories Iolaus shared with its kind, the dying behemothor was called Sansamin. Sansamin had always been an outsider, a renegade, almost an outlaw. It had disappeared from polite society thousands of years ago, and was presumed to be haunting the less hospitable and less fashionable volumes of the air sphere, perhaps alone, possibly in the company of the small number of other misfit behemothors known to exist. There had been a few hazy, unconfirmed sightings of the creature over the first several centuries of its self-imposed exile, but nothing for the last few. Now, it had been rediscovered. But it was at war with itself, and about to die. Flocks of falficors surrounded the giant in squabbling clouds, feeding off its foliage and outer skins. Smerines and fuelarids, the largest winged creatures in the air sphere, divided their time between the living flesh of the behemothor and the swarming clusters of falficors, driven to recklessness by the sheer glut of food on offer. The sleekly bulbous bodies of two ogrine dicyosaurs, a rare form of lithe behemothor, only 100 meters in length and the world's largest predator, swam through the air in tremendous sinuous flicks, dipping to tear pieces from the body of Sansamin, and snapping up handfuls of careless falficors, and even the occasional smerine and fuelarid. Tendon-strutted fragments of behemothor skin fell into the blueness below, like dark sails torn from cyclone-struck clippers. Puffs of gas made brief, dispersing vapor clouds in the air as the colossal creature's outer ballonets and gas sacs were ruptured. The torn bodies of falficors, smerines, and fuelarids tumbled in bloody, cartwheeling spirals into the abyss, their screams frighteningly close in the compacted depth of air, yet nearly drowned out in the vast noise of frenzied feeding going on all about. The raptor scouts, cloud attackers, envelopian defenders, and other creatures which were part of Sansamin's dispersed self, and that would normally easily have kept such aggressors at bay, were nowhere to be seen. The remains of a few had been discovered where they had fallen, and been picked clean by others. The most telling pair of skeletons had been found with their jaws clamped around the other's neck. Eugen's Leap stood on the seemingly solid surface of the dirigible behemothor's vast back, looking out over a landscape of tattered, withered skin foliage, being torn apart by falficor flocks. He stood beside the 7-meter-wide bulk of the signaling pod. It was anchored to the envelope's surface by a dozen small hooks made from falficor talons, and tended to by a handful of deciders nearly identical to 974 Praff. Spread in a circle about them were 100 of Iolaus's raptor scouts, forming a living defensive barrier, which was patrolled from above by another 50 or 60 of the creatures, flying slow circuits. So far they had repelled all attacks, and had not lost any of their number. Even one of the ogrine dicyosaurs, obviously intrigued by the activity round the signalling pod, had turned tail when confronted by 20 of the raptor scouts in attack formation, and returned instead to the easier pickings on offer all over the dying behemothor's surface. 200 meters away, across Sansamin's back, near the knobbled ridge of a Longeron spine, a smerine swooped down, scattering the smaller creatures in a blizzard of piercing cries. It thudded into a giant wound in the behemothor's skin. Eugen saw the flesh around the tear ripple under impact. The predator flapped its 20-meter wings and dipped its long head, flaying the exposed tissue. A gas sac, severed from its supporting structure, wobbled out of the spreading wound and into the air. It began to climb. The Smerine looked up but let it go. The Falficor flock above attacked it, screeching, until it punctured and jetted slowly off, deflating in a long, exhaling scream of gas and scattering enraged Falficors behind it. There was a thud at his feet. Eugen jumped. "Oh, Prath," he said, as the interpreter stowed its wings. It had gone with a dozen of the raptor scouts to investigate the interior of the behemothor. "Find anything?" he asked. 974 Prath watched the distant gas sac as it finally fell, deflated, into the foliage forest near Sansamin's upper forefins. "We have found something. Come and look." "Inside?" Eugen asked nervously. "Yes." "Is it safe?" "In there?" 974 Prath looked up at him. The central gas bladders. The hydrogen core. I thought there was a possibility those might... That is, it might... An explosion is possible," 974 Prath said in a matter-of-fact manner. "This would be of a catastrophic nature." Eugen felt himself gulp. "Catastrophic?" "Yes. The dirigible behemothor Sansamin would be destroyed."
"Yes.
And, us?"
"Two."
"Two?"
"We two would be destroyed."
"Yes. Well then, this outcome will grow more likely with delay. Therefore, delay is not wise. Expedition is advisable." 974 Prath shuffled its feet. "Extremely advisable."
"Prath," Eugen said, "do we have to do this?"
The creature rocked back on its heel talons and squinted up at him.
"Of course. It is duty to the Iolaus."
"And if I say no?"
"What do you mean?"
"What if I refuse to go inside and look at whatever it is you found?"
"Then our investigations will take longer."
Eugen stared at the interpreter.
"Longer?"
"Of course."
"What have you found?"
"We do not know."
"Then
it is a creature."
"A creature?"
"Many creatures. All dead but one. Of an unknown type."
"What sort of unknown type?"
"That is what is unknown."
"Well, what does it look like?"
"It looks a little like you."
The creature looked like an alien child's doll, thrown against a barbed wall and left hanging there. It was long, with a tail that was half its body length. The head was broad, furred, and he thought striped, though in the darkness, using only his IR sense, he couldn't tell what colours its pelt might be. The creature's big, forward-facing eyes were closed. It had a thick neck, broad shoulders, two arms about the size of a large human's, but with very wide, heavy hands, which looked more like paws. Only a dirigible behemothor, or one of its acolytes, would have imagined it looked much like Eugen's leap. It was one of 20 similar forms strung out along one wall of the chamber. All the others were dead and rotting. Below the creature's arms, supported by a second, still wider set of shoulders, rested what at first appeared to be a giant flap of furred skin. Looking closer, Eugen realized this was a limb. A dark pad of toughened skin extended across its end in an 8 shape, and stubby hints of toes or claws dotted the perimeter of the pad. Below the torso, two powerful-looking legs hung from a broad set of hips. A furred mound probably concealed genitals of some sort. The tail was striped. One of the root cables Eugen had seen attached to the raptor scout in the similar chamber in Iolaus led from the back of the creature's head and into the ribbed wall behind. The smell in here was even worse than it had been in Iolaus. The journey had been horrific. Dirigible behemothors were riddled with fissures, chambers, cavities, and tunnels, disposed so that their collection of tributary fauna could carry out their various tasks. Many of these were large enough to admit raptor scouts, and it was down one of these that they had journeyed from an entrance behind the behemothor's rear dorsal fin complex. The effects of the creature's own attendant entities turning against it were everywhere. Great gouges and tears had been slashed through the tunnel's walls, making the curved floor slick with liquid in some places and cloyingly sticky in others. Flaps of decaying tissue hung from the ceiling like obscene banners, and rents in the floor could swallow a leg, a wing, or even, certainly in Eugen's case, a whole body. Here and there, smaller creatures still feasted upon the body of the being they had served. Other corpses littered the floor of the winding tunnel, and where the two raptor scouts accompanying 974 Praff and Eugen's leap down into the body of the behemothor could do so without delaying their progress, they swiped out at the parasites and tore them to pieces, leaving them twitching on the floor behind. Finally, they had arrived at the chamber where the behemothor sought knowledge from its self-kin and guests. A great tremor ran through the cavern just as they entered, making the walls shake and dislodging some of the half-rotted bodies. Two of the specialist raptor scouts had clawed their way up the wall beside the creature, which still appeared to be alive. They were intent on an examination of its head, where the cable route disappeared into it. One of the raptor scouts held something small and glittering.
"Do you know the nature of this being?" 974 Praff asked.
Eugen stared up at the creature.
"No," he said.
"Well, not properly. It looks vaguely familiar. I might have seen it on screen or something, but I don't know what it is."
"It is not of your sort?"
"Well, of course not. Look at it. It's bigger, it's got enormous eyes, and a totally different sort of head. I mean, I'm not of my sort, not originally, if you know what I mean," he said, turning to Praff, who blinked up at him. "But the main thing, difference, is that middle bit. That looks like a sort of extra leg and foot. Well, like two that have grown together. Do you see those, ridges? I'll bet those are the bones of what used to be two separate legs in its forebears, before it evolved into a single limb."
"It is not known to you?"
Sorry, no."
"Do you think if it can be made to speak, it will be able to be understood in its talking by you?"
"What?"
"It is not dead. It is linked to the mind of the Sansamin, but the mind of the Sansamin is dead. But the creature is not dead. If we are able to sever its link to the mind of the Sansamin, which is dead, then it might be able to speak. If this were to happen, would you be able to understand that which it says?"
"Oh, I doubt it."
"That is unfortunate."
974 Praff was silent for a moment.
"And yet this means that we would be wise to sever its link soon rather than later. And that is good, because then we would be less likely to die when the Sansamin suffers its catastrophic explosion."
"What?"
Eugen yelped. The interpreter started to repeat itself, talking slightly slower, but he waved both hands at it.
"Never mind. Sever its links now. Let's get out, quick. I mean, quickly."
"This will be done,"
974 Praff said. It babbled and clicked at the two raptor scouts clinging to the wall by the side of the alien creature. They turned and jabbered back. There seemed to be a disagreement. Another tremor shook the whole chamber. The floor under Eugen's feet quaked. He put his arms out to each side to balance himself and felt his mouth go dry. There was a draught, Then a distinct breeze of warm air, scented with a smell he suspected was methane. It took most of the smell of rotting flesh away, but he felt sickened with terror. His skin had gone cold and clammy.
"Please, let's go," he whispered.
The raptor scouts on either side of the hanging creature did something behind its head. It slumped forward and down. Then the thing trembled, as though shivering, and brought its head back up. It worked its jaw, then opened its eyes. They were very large and black. It looked around, at the raptor scouts on either side, at the rest of the chamber, then at 974 Prath, then at Eugen's leap. It made a sound, or set of sounds, but it was no language that Eugen had ever heard before.
"This is not a speech form which is known to you?" the interpreter asked.
On the barbed wall of living, dying tissue, the alien creature's eyes went suddenly wide.
"No," Eugen said. "Doesn't mean a thing to me, I'm afraid. Look, can we please, please get the hell out of here?"
You there,"
gasped the creature on the wall, in accented but recognizable Marain. It was staring at Eugen, who was staring right back.
"Help me,"
it wheezed.
What?
Eugen heard himself say.
"Please,"
the creature said.
"Culture! Agent!"
It swallowed with obvious pain and croaked.
"Plot! Assassin! Need! Get word! Please! Help! Urgent! Very urgent!"
Eugen tried to speak, but could not. There was a smell of something burning in the wind blowing through the chamber. 974 Prath adjusted her footing as another huge tremor shook the chamber and made the floor swell. She looked from Eugen to the creature on the wall and back again.
"This speech form is known to you?" she asked.
Eugen nodded. The Memory of Running. The figure seemed to coalesce out of nothing, out of the air. Anyone or anything watching would have needed more than natural senses to have noticed the slow fall of dust spread out over an hour of time and a radial kilometre of the grasslands. That anything out of the ordinary was happening would only have become obvious a little later, when an odd sort of wind seemed to stir itself out of the gentle breeze, disturbing the grass on the broad plain and producing what appeared to be a slowly revolving dust devil, whirling quietly in the air and gradually shrinking and tightening and darkening and speeding up until suddenly it disappeared. And where it had been, there stood what looked like a tall and graceful Chelgrian female, dressed in the country day clothes of the Given caste. The first thing she did when she felt she was complete was to crouch down and dig into the earth beneath the grass with her fingers. Her claws slid out, spearing the ground. She ripped out a handful of the soil and grass. She held the handful of earth and vegetation up to her broad, dark nose and sniffed slowly. She was waiting. She had nothing better to do for the moment, and so she thought that she would take a good hard look and a good long sniff at the ground she stood on. There were so many different tones and flavours to the smell. The grass held a spectrum of odours of its own, all of them fresher and brighter than the heavy notes of the soil, giving it a scent of the air and the winds rather than the ground. She raised her head, letting the breeze ruffle her head fur. She took in the view. It was almost perfectly simple. Ankle-high grass stretching in every direction. There was a hint of cloud to the far northeast, where the Giseli Mountains were. She had seen them on the way down. Above, and everywhere else in the sky, just aquamarine clarity. No sign of contrails. That was good. The sun was halfway up the southern sky. To the north, both moons shone full face, and a single day star twinkled near the eastern horizon. She was aware of some part of her mind using the information in the sky to calculate her position, the time, and the precise compass direction she was facing in. The resulting knowledge made its existence felt, but did not force itself upon her. It was like the presence of somebody in an anteroom, signaled by a polite knock on the door. She called up another layer of data, and was presented with an overlay across the sky. Suddenly, she could see a grid superimposed across the heavens, and drawn on it were the paths of numerous satellites and a few suborbital transport craft with identities attached, and a further stratum of more finely detailed information on each implied. The satellites, whose images were slowly flashing, were the ones which had been interfered with. Then she saw a couple of dots on the eastern horizon and turned to them, her eyes adjusting. Inside her, something exactly like a heart thumped hard and fast for a single beat before she could control it again. Some of the earth fell from the handful she held. The dots were birds, a few hundred meters away. She relaxed. The birds rose into the air, facing each other and flapping wildly. They were half displaying, half fighting. There would be a female sitting crouched in the grass nearby, watching the two males. The scientific and common names of the species, their range, feeding and mating habits, and a variety of other information about the creatures seemed to hover at the back of her mind. The two birds fell back into the grass again. Their calls came thinly through the air. She had never heard their voices before, but knew that they sounded as they ought to. Of course, it was still possible that the birds were not as innocent and unthreatening as they appeared. They might be real but altered animals, or not biological at all. In either case, they might be part of a surveillance system. Well, there was nothing to be done. She would go on waiting a little longer. She returned her attention to the clump of turf she held, bringing it up to her eyes, soaking up the sight. There were many different types of grasses and tiny plants in the handful, most of them a pale yellow-green colour. She saw seeds, roots, tendrils, petals, husks, blades, and stems. The relevant information, describing each different species, duly made its existence known at the back of her mind. She was, by now, also aware that the data presenting itself had already been evaluated by some other part of her mind. If anything had looked wrong or seemed out of place, if, for example, those birds had moved in a manner so as to imply that they were heavier than they were supposed to be, then her attention would have been drawn to the anomaly. So far, everything seemed to be reassuringly normal. The data was a distant, comforting awareness, patiently lingering on the outskirts of her perception. A few tiny animals moved within the mass of soil and on the surfaces of the vegetation. She knew their names and details too. She watched a pale, thread-thin worm waving about blindly in the humus. She put the divot back, pressing the clump of soil into the hole it had left and patting it down. She dusted off her hands while she looked around once more. Still no sign of anything amiss. The birds in the distance rose into the air again, then descended. A warm wave of air unfolded itself across the surface of the grass and flowed around her, stroking her fur where it was not covered by her plain hide waistcoat and pants. She picked up her cloak and fastened it round her shoulders. It became part of her, just like the waistcoat and pants. The wind came from the west. It was freshening, taking the cries of the displaying birds away, so that when they rose in the distance for a third time, they seemed to do so quite silently. There was just a hint, a faint tang of salt in the wind. It was sufficient to decide her. Enough of waiting. She looped the cloak's tail loop over her long, tawny tail, then turned her face to the wind. She wished that she had chosen a name. If she had, she would have spoken it now, voiced it to the clear air like some declaration of intent. But she did not have a name, because she was not what she appeared to be. Not a Chelgrian female. Not a Chelgrian. Not even a biological creature at all. I am a culture terror weapon, she thought, designed to horrify, warn, and instruct at the highest level. A name would have been a lie. She checked her orders, just to be sure. It was true. She had complete discretion in the manner. A lack of instruction could be interpreted as a quite specific instruction. She could do anything. She was off the leash. Very well. She leant back on her rear legs and brought her arms up to slip them into the glove pouches at the top of her waistcoat. Then, with an initial bound very like a pounce, she set off, settling quickly into an easy-looking lope that carried her away across the grass in a series of long, smoothly sinuous bounds that stretched and compressed her powerful back and brought her heavily muscled rear legs and broad mid-limb almost together, then pushed them flying apart with every surging leap. She felt the joy of the run and understood the ancient rightness of the wind in her face and fur. To run, to chase, to hunt, to bring down and kill. The cloak rippled across her back in the slipstream. Her tail flicked from side to side. Chapter 9. Pylon Country. I had almost forgotten this place existed myself. Kabe looked at the silver-skinned avatar.
Really?
Nothing much has happened here for 200 years, apart from gentle decay, the creature explained.
Couldn't that be said of the whole orbital? Zilla asked, in what was probably meant to be a falsely innocent tone.
The avatar pretended to look hurt.
The antique cable car creaked around them as it swung round a tall pylon. It rumbled and squeaked through a system of overhead points, hanging from a ring round the mast's top, and then tacked away on a new heading towards a distant pylon on a small hill across the fractured plain.
"Do you ever forget anything, Hub?" Kabe asked the avatar.
"Only if I choose to," it said in its hollow voice. It was half sitting, half lying on one of the plump, red-polished hide couches, its booted feet up on the brass rail, which separated the rear passenger compartment from the pilot's control deck, where Zilla was standing, watching the various instruments, adjusting levers, and fiddling with a variety of ropes that emerged from a slot in the car's floor and were tied off on cleats mounted on the forward bulkhead.
"And do you ever choose to?" Kabe asked.
He was squatting trefoil on the floor. There was just enough headroom for him in the ornate cabin like that. The car was designed to carry about a dozen passengers and two crew. The avatar frowned.
"Not that I can recall." Kabe laughed. "So, you might choose to forget something, then choose to forget forgetting it."
"Ah, but then I'd have to forget forgetting the original forgetting."
"I suppose you would."
"Is this conversation going anywhere?" Zilla shouted over his shoulder.
"No," said the avatar. "It's like this journey. Drifting."
"We are not drifting," Zilla said. "We are exploring."
"You might be," the avatar said. "I'm not. I can see exactly where we are from Hub Central."
"What do you want to see?"
I can provide detailed maps if you'd like.
The spirit of adventure and exploration is obviously alien to your computer soul, Zilla told it.
The avatar reached out and flicked a speck of dust from the top of one boot.
Do I have a soul? Is that meant to be a compliment? Of course you don't have a soul, Zilla said,
pulling hard on one rope and tying it off. The cable car picked up speed, swaying gently as it crossed the scrub-strewn plain. Kabe watched the car's shadow as it undulated over the dustily fawn and red ground below. The dark outline slid away and lengthened as they crossed a dry, gravel-braided riverbed. A gust of wind raised eddies of dust on the ground below, then hit the car and tipped it fractionally, making the glass windows rattle in their wooden frames.
That's good, the avatar said, because I didn't think I had one, and if I did, I must have forgotten.
Ha ha, said Kabe. Zilla made an exasperated sound. They were in a wind-powered cable car crossing the Epsizia Breaks, a huge area of semi-wilderness on Canthropa Plate, nearly a quarter way spinwards around the orbital from Zilla and Kabe's homes on Zarav and Osinorsi. The Breaks were a vast dried-up river system, 1,000 kilometers broad and 3 times that in length. From space, they looked thrown across the dun plains of Canthropa like 1,000,000 twisted lengths of grey and ochre string. The Breaks rarely carried much water. There was the occasional rain shower over the plains, but the region remained semi-arid. Every 100 or so years, a really big storm managed to cross the Canthrops, the mountain range between the plains and Sard Ocean, which occupied the whole of the plate to spinward. And only then did the river system live up to its name, transporting the fallen rain from the mountains to the Epsizia Pans, which filled and shimmered for a few days and supported a brief riot of plant and animal life before drying to salty mudflats again. The Breaks had been designed to be that way. Massac had been modelled and planned as carefully as any other orbital, but it had always been envisaged as a big world and a varied one. It contained just about every form of geography possible, given its apparent gravity and human-friendly atmosphere, and most of that geography was human-friendly too. But it was rare for any self-respecting orbital hub to be happy without at least some wilderness around. Humans tended to complain after a while, too. Filling every available bit of each and every plate with gently rolling hills and babbling brooks, or even spectacular mountains and broad oceans, was not seen as producing a properly balanced orbital environment. There ought to be wastes. There should be badlands. The Epsizia Breaks were just one of hundreds of different types of wasteland scattered about Massac. They were dry and windy and barren, but otherwise one of the more hospitable badlands. People had always come to the Breaks. They came to walk, to camp out under the stars and the far-side light, and feel themselves apart from things for a while. And though a few people had tried living there, almost nobody had stayed for more than a few hundred days. Kabe was looking out over Zilla's head through the front windscreen of the car. From the tall pylon they were heading for, cables stretched away in 6 different directions along lines of masts disappearing into the distance, some in straight lines, others in lazy curves. Looking out over the fractured landscape all around, Kabe could see the pylons, each between 20 and 60 meters high and shaped like an inverted L, everywhere. He could see why the Epsizia Breaks were also known as Pylon Country.
Why was the system built in the first place? Kabe asked.
He had been quizzing the avatar about the cable car system when it had made its remark about almost forgetting the place existed.
All down to a man called Bragan Latry, the avatar said, stretching out across the couch and clasping its hands behind its head.
1100 years ago, he got it into his head that what this place really needed was a system of sailing cable cars.
But why? Kabe asked.
The Avatar shrugged.
No idea. This was before my watch, don't forget. Back in the time of my predecessor, the one who sublimed.
You mean you didn't inherit any records from it?
Zilla asked incredulously.
Don't be ridiculous. Of course I inherited a full suite of records and archives.
The Avatar stared up at the ceiling and shook its head.
Looking back, it's very much as though I was there.
It shrugged.
There just wasn't any record of exactly why Bregan Latry decided to start covering the breaks in pylons.
He just thought there should be this here.
Apparently.
Perfectly fine idea, Zilla said.
He pulled on a line, tightening one of the sails underneath the car with a squeak of wheels and pulleys.
And so your predecessor built it for him, Kabe asked.
The Avatar snorted derisively.
Certainly not. This place was designed as wilderness.
It couldn't see any good reason to start running cables all over it.
No, it told him to do it himself.
Kabe looked round the haze horizon. He could see hundreds of pylons from here.
He built all this himself?
In a manner of speaking, the Avatar said, still staring up at the ceiling, which was painted with scenes of ancient rustic life. He asked for manufacturing capacity and design time, and he found a sentient airship, which also thought it would be a hoot to dot pylons all over the breaks. He designed the pylons and the cars, had them manufactured, and then he and the airship, and a few other people he'd talked into supporting the project, started putting the pylons up and stringing the cables in between.
Didn't anyone object?
He kept it quiet for a surprisingly long time, but yes, people did object.
There are always critics, Zilla muttered.
He was studying a huge paper chart through a magnifying glass.
But they let him go ahead.
Grief, no, the Avatar said. They started taking the pylons down. Some people like their wilderness just as it is.
But obviously, Mr. Latry prevailed, Kabe said,
looking round again. They were approaching the mast on the low hill. The ground was rising towards the car's lower sails, and their shadow was growing closer all the time.
He just kept building the pylons, and the airship and his pals kept planting them. And the preservationeers...
The Avatar turned and glanced at Kabe. They had a name by this time, always a bad sign.
Kept taking them down. More and more people joined in on both sides, until the place was swarming with people putting up pylons and hanging cable off them, rapidly followed by people tearing everything down and carting it away again.
Didn't they vote on it?
Kabe knew this was how disputes tended to be settled in the culture. The Avatar rolled its eyes.
Oh, they voted.
And Mr. Latry won.
Nope, he lost.
So how come... Actually, they had lots of votes. It was one of those rolling campaigns where they had to vote on who would be allowed to vote. Just people who'd been to the breaks, people who lived on Canthropa, everybody on Masark, or what?
And Mr. Latry lost.
He lost the first vote, with those eligible to vote restricted to those who'd been to the breaks before. Would you believe there was one proposal to weight everybody's votes according to how many times they'd been here, and another to give them a vote for each day they'd been here? The Avatar shook its head.
Believe me, democracy in action can be an unpretty sight.
So he lost that one, and in theory my predecessor was then mandated to stop the manufacturing. But then the people who hadn't been allowed to vote were complaining, and so there was another ballot, and this time it was the whole plate population plus people who'd been to the breaks.
And he won that one.
No, he lost that one too. The preservationeers had some very good PR, better than the pylonists.
They had a name too by this time, Kabe asked.
Of course.
This isn't going to be one of those idiotic local disputes that end up being put to a vote of the whole culture, is it? Zilla said, still poring over his chart. He looked up briefly at the avatar. I mean, that doesn't really happen, does it? He asked.
It really happens, the avatar said, its voice sounding particularly hollow. More often than you'd think. But no, in this case, the quarrel never went out of Masak's jurisdiction.
The avatar frowned, as though finding something objectionable in the painted scene overhead.
Oh, Zilla, by the way, mind that pylon.
What? The Chelgrian said. He glanced up. The pylon on the hill was only 5 meters away.
Oh, shit!
He dropped the chart and the magnifying glass and moved quickly to adjust the levers controlling the car's overhead steering wheels. There was a clanking, grinding noise from overhead. The stubby pylon whooshed past to starboard, its foam metal girders streaked with bird droppings and dotted with lichen. The cable car shook and rattled as it crunched over the first set of points, while Zilla loosened his ropes, letting the sails flap free. The car was now on a sort of ring round the top of the pylon, from which the other cable routes left. A set of vanes on the top of the pylon powered a chain drive set into the ring, pulling the car round. Zilla watched a pair of hanging metal boards go past. They bore large numbers in fading, flaking paint. At the third board, he shoved one of the steering levers forward. The car's overhead wheels reconnected, and with a screech of metal and a sudden jolt, it slipped onto the appropriate cable, sliding down by gravity alone at first, until Zilla hauled on his ropes and reconfigured the sails to haul the swaying, gently bouncing car along a long, bowed length of cable that led to another distant hillock.
There, Zilla said.
But eventually Mr. Lattry got his way, Kabe said. Obviously.
Obviously, the avatar agreed. In the end, he just got enough people sufficiently enthused about the whole ridiculous scheme. The final vote was over the whole orbital. The preservationeers saved face by getting him to agree he wouldn't clutter up any other wildernesses, even though there was no evidence to show he had any plans to do so in the first place. So he went ahead, planting pylons, spinning cables and producing cars to his heart's content. Lots of people helped. He had to form separate teams with a couple of airships each, and some went their own way, though they mostly worked under a general plan drawn up by Lattry. The only interruptions came during the Iderian War, and once I'd taken over, in the Shaladian crisis, when I had to commandeer all the spare production capacity to be ready to build ships and military stuff. Even then he kept building pylons and spinning cables using homemade machinery some of his followers had built. By the time he had finished, 600 years after he had started, he had covered almost the whole of the breaks in pylons. And that's why it's called Pylon Country.
That's 3 million square kilometers, Zilla said.
He had retrieved the chart and the magnifying glass and gone back to studying one through the other.
Near enough, the avatar said, uncrossing then recrossing its legs.
I counted the number of pylons once and totted up the kilometrage of cable.
And? Kabe asked.
The avatar shook its head.
They were both very big numbers,
but otherwise uninteresting.
I could search them out for you if you wanted, but...
Please, Kabe said, not on my account.
So, did Mr. Lattry die with his life's work completed? Zilla asked.
He was staring out of a side window now and scratching his head. He held the map up and turned it one way, then the other.
No, the avatar said. Mr. Lattry was not one of life's dyers.
He spent a few years travelling the cables in a car, all by himself, but eventually he grew bored with it. He did some deep space cruising, then settled on an orbital called Kaila, 60,000 years away from here.
hasn't been here or even inquired about the cable car system, to my knowledge, for over a century. Last I heard, he was trying to persuade a pack of GSVs to take part in a scheme to induce patterns of sunspots on his local star so they'd spell out names and mottos. Well, Zilla said, staring at the chart again, they say a man should have a hobby. At the moment, yours seems to be keeping about 2 million kilometers between you and our Major Quillen, the Avatar observed. Zilla looked up. Heavens, are we really that far from home? Pretty much. And how is our emissary? Is he enjoying himself? Has he settled into his billet? Has he sent any souvenir cards back home yet? It was 6 days after Quillen had arrived on the Resistance's character forming. The Major had liked his quarters in Yawl City, on the plate of the same name, well enough. Yawl was 2 plates, 2 continents, away from Akeem City, where Zilla lived. The Major had visited Akeem a couple of times since, once accompanied by Kabe, once alone. On each occasion, he had announced his intention and asked Hub to tell Zilla what he was doing. Zilla wasn't spending much time at home anyway. He was visiting parts of the orbital he hadn't seen before, or, as today, places he'd been to before and been taken with. He has settled in very well, Hub said, through the Avatar. Shall I tell him you were asking after him? Better not. We don't want him getting too excited.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 5 of Look to Windward.